This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This is a story that, like a lot of stories, begins with a journey. When the journey began, almost 25 years ago, the fellow who made it was perhaps 10. He's not sure. He spoke with me recently from Burundi.
Hello.
Hi, is this Benjamin?
Yes, I'm Benjamin. I'm just getting outside.
Okay.
Because somewhere there was noise.
Benjamin Nazbonakira is a survivor, and in order to survive, he had to take that journey. It began in Burundi, where Benjamin had been enjoying a childhood he describes as normal. He told me his family was not rich, not poor. And then that family and many, many other families were suddenly confronted with civil war.
That was in 1993, when the first democratic president was killed. Our situation became very tense, and we were obliged to flee the country.
Benjamin's journey led him to a refugee camp in Rwanda. Within a few months, the genocide that would tear that country apart made living in the camps more dangerous than living in Burundi had been. The journey continued. The refugees survived by eating leaves off the trees. Benjamin made it to the Democratic Republic of Congo briefly. There, his mother and youngest sister died in the forest when militias chased them out of that country. Benjamin eventually reached Tanzania. By then, he was alone, having been separated from the remaining members of his family. The politics and conflicts at each stop must have been impossibly confusing to children like Benjamin, but he understood immediately and every day that he was hungry.
In my home country, I didn't spend a day without having meal, such as breakfast, lunch, or dinner. It was very strange people there, strange conditions. Actually come to recognize that, will life be like this?
Hunger wasn't the only problem. Children like Benjamin were often bullied into joining militias. Some of them did that. According to Benjamin, others spent their days sleeping and crying. And that's how things might have remained if it hadn't been for a champion speed skater from Norway named Johan Koss. Before the 1994 Winter Olympics in his home country, Norway's Olympic Organizing Committee asked Koss to travel to Eritrea to represent a relief organization called Olympic Aid.
And when I got there, I met a group of boys, and one was very popular, and I asked, why are you so popular? And he looked at me and said, can't you see it's a long sleeves? Well, and he took off his shirt, rolled it together, and sleeves made a knot, and that became the ball, and that's how they played soccer in the streets of the slums of Asmara, which is in Eritrea, where I visited. And I'm like, Eamon, have you ever had a ball? Have you ever had a team, a coach? You know, and they looked at me like I came from a different planet.
On the planet Johan Koss called home, superb athletes trained for years in order to dazzle millions of television viewers. Koss says the trip to Eritrea helped him put his training in a context he'd never before considered.
When you train so much and so hard, it's very hard to find that deeper motivation. And if you can find a purpose for what you're doing broader than yourself, which was for me, to provide these kids with a sport opportunity, that led me to become a much better athlete, actually.
Motivated in part by the purpose he discovered in Eritrea, Koss turned in a spectacular performance at the Winter Games. He won 3 gold medals, setting a new world record in each of his races. At a press conference after his second win, Koss announced that he would donate all of the bonuses he'd earned from the Olympic Committee and his sponsors to Olympic Aid. He challenged the Norwegian people to donate as well, and he must have been convincing. Some of the journalists in the room opened their wallets and handed him money on the spot. And then Koss went back to Africa.
As I had promised, I collected 13 tons of sport equipment spread all around Norway. And listen, I was 25. I had no idea about international development. But I was very stubborn. And I was flying down to Eritrea. And then the newspaper in Norway wrote that, you know, Koss is bringing soccer ball to starving children. What an idiot. And I'm not used to be called an idiot. Certainly not at that time. But when I arrived, I never in my life been met by so many people. I mean, there was over 100,000 people in the street of Asmara. They had Norwegian and Eritrean flags. They put me on the bike. We were riding through the streets. I got up to the president's palace, and I met with him, and he, I said to him, you know, I'm bringing soccer balls, might have been a mistake, because he himself called for food, and he said, looked at me and said, you know, this is the first time we feel like human beings, something more than just being kept alive.
Soccer balls in Eritrea was just the beginning, and Koss soon discovered that the children in the refugee camps had even less than the child in the street in Asmara with the long-sleeved shirt. He founded the organization Right to Play to bring sports to refugee camps, including the camp at Lekole, where Benjamin had settled. Benjamin was kicking around a soccer ball made of banana leaves and twine when the coaches arrived.
They were driving the truck with the big megaphones and say, come to the field. And many times there were not even fields, so they had to kind of break ground and make that happen first. You know, people say, you know, sometimes when you do these programs, oh, when you're going to see effect, it's going to be taking, you know, months and years before you see any impact on that, you know. And then, you know, after 3 weeks, we had like the whole camp lined up.
When they come and play, things changed. They become very, very excited and try a bit to forget about the bad experience they went through.
Benjamin Nasbonakira remembers what the coaches said to him as they helped him learn to play.
You have to love each other, even those who made you fled. You have to love them. In that way, you become champion.
In the camp, Benjamin had plenty of opportunity to try putting that advice into practice. The bullying came with a hard, sometimes fatal edge. But playing soccer with bullies taught Benjamin that they could work together, and perhaps more significantly, playing together taught many of these children who had lost so much that they were not so different from each other. It would turn out to be a lesson with appeal beyond the borders of the camp. A children's book author named Katie Smith Milway would demonstrate that.
Dale Raccundo didn't know why the war began in his country, but he knew that one dark night his family was forced to flee their hillside farm and its terraces of sweet potatoes, beans, and bananas.
For her book, titled The Banana Leaf Ball, Milway created a little boy named Deo, a boy in a camp called Lekole in northwest Tanzania, who tries to make a ball out of banana leaves and twine only to see his meager materials stolen by a bully named Remy. When the coach, modeled on one of Johann Koss's recruits, arrives in the village, the children learn to be teammates. Together, they win a game.
Everyone is out of breath, tired, and happy. Remy, the bully, squeezes Deo's neck again, but more gently this time. We did it, he says. Soon, all the shirts have their arms around one another, singing a victory song, stomping the ground and laughing.
Milway says she was on the prowl for a good story about social and emotional learning when she was reminded of the program Johann Koss had been running in refugee camps.
And I thought, okay, I've got to call this guy. So I called him up and I said, do you have a good story of the power of play? And he said, oh, you've got to read the speech of one of my staff members in Burundi. That's how I got to know Benjamin's story.
The challenge for Milway was turning a journey that had included the loss of family members and the death of innocents into a tale for children.
I hope to write a story that would actually resonate with kids in any playground anywhere, because playgrounds are not always welcoming. You know, the bully might be a militia recruiter, as in the case of Benjamin, but it might be a gang member in an urban school, and it also just might be someone who's mean.
Benjamin has no problem with Milway's adaptation of his story, and he doesn't mind the name change.
There was Benjamin, actually, there. But there's no different. Deo, Benjamin, just the same. It can be someone else. Benjamin, Deo, Nick, Kathy, or someone else. It's okay.
Actually, it's a lot better than okay. It's a powerful story. And in telling it, even though the story is for kids, Milway hasn't pulled all her punches. You say at the end of the book, there's a section called A Real Deo. It begins, and I'm quoting, today almost 60 million people are refugees. Men, women, and children who've had to leave their homes because of war, disaster. That's in the book. What do you intend for children to make of that news?
Oh, well, first of all, it's good for them to realize that the experience of children around the world is very different. And I think, I hope kids who read the book develop a lot of empathy for kids in need. I hope that translates into a welcoming spirit for, you know, people of political asylum, a welcoming spirit for refugees that need a new home and a new start. But I also hope it helps kids find themselves no matter what playground they play on, and think about that kid that maybe they don't like so much and try to learn their story.
It might seem like a lot of hope to hang on a children's book, but maybe not. At least one reader has lots of confidence that the message in the banana leaf ball will resonate with kids, maybe even inspire them.
I thought that I cannot become someone, but I actually come to realize that finally Benjamin's story is somehow interesting. And I'm very grateful to Kath. She did a very interesting work, especially when people read this kind of book, they can really experience how with the play, everything can be possible.
Benjamin became a coach for Right to Play, and more recently, now back in Burundi, he has founded an organization of his own to bring play to kids who need it. Benjamin's work is driven by his determination to help at least some of the estimated 28 million of the world's children classified as displaced. The man who traveled as a child from Burundi to Rwanda to Congo to Tanzania knows displaced, and he knows need beyond food and shelter. You can find a link to the banana leaf ball at onlyagame.org. There's multitasking, and then there's what former Major League pinch hitter Gale Hopkins did.
I do have the ability to stay up late, work long hours, and still be rested.
When all the guys were going out and drinking or doing other things, he was studying, and he would study in the bullpen, and he would study all the time.
Meet the major leaguer who mastered the degrees of difficulty required to make the bigs while earning several difficult degrees, coming up on Only a Game from NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Cleveland Cavaliers and the Golden State Warriors will once again meet in the NBA Finals. Fans of the other teams can stake their hopes for the future on the NBA Draft coming up on June 22nd, and that's where we're going to start this week on Three Stories You Should Know. My guests are The Ringer's Claire McNear and The Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay. Welcome back to both of you.
Great to be back.
Hey, Bill.
Potential top pick Lonzo Ball has made it clear that he wants to be a Laker. He's declined an invitation to work out for the Celtics, who have the number one pick in this draft. And it looks as if he may work out for the 76ers, but maybe he won't work out for anybody else unless they're the Lakers. Not the first aspiring pro to make his preferences known, but I wonder if he represents a trend. Are we going to see a time when players, or at least the most desirable players, call the shots when the draft rolls around? I kind of like the idea, I got to say. Why shouldn't players have a say in where they want to go to work? And why shouldn't they have that say right from the beginning of their careers rather than having to wait to become free agents? Owners would squirm. They would cry poor. There would be all sorts of objections from them. So what, say I. Claire, what do you think?
Yeah, I would have to agree with you insofar as it's a player stating a preference. I think nobody, not the team and definitely not the fans, wants a player who's unhappy with the team they're on, whether it's because of the way the team is set up, as I think it is in this case, supposedly, or it's about the city. So I don't see any problem with an athlete stating their preference, and it becomes just another thing for a team to consider.
Jason, will you stand up for owners?
Well, look, we can't have a scenario whereby players just pick what team they go to out of the entry draft. Otherwise, why wouldn't you just want to go to the Cavaliers or to the Golden State Warriors? I like the sort of pensive looks on these draft picks' faces when they realize they've been sentenced to 4 years in the Sacramento Kings franchise. I love that.
You're a sadist.
Let's not forget also that these kinds of draft day engineerings go back generations. We remember, of course, Bill, Jack Elway getting John Elway away from the midst of the Baltimore Colts going to Denver. And more recently, Archie Manning helping to maneuver his son Eli away from the midst of the San Diego Chargers and to the New York Giants. Turns out both dads were kind of right.
I just would like to see players have a little more to say about where they went. And I recognize it's not going to happen in the interest of parity and all that, but it was kind of fun to bring it up anyway. Claire, you can't see me right now, but I am pretending to make a snow angel. right here in the studio. Do I get penalized?
You certainly do not. And we know whether or not you have snow. So this week, Commissioner Roger Goodell announced new end zone celebration rules for the coming NFL season. And there are three big changes. One, you can now use the football as a prop to celebrate. Two, you can celebrate as a group. And three, you can roll around on the ground in celebration, which most often will probably mean snow angels. Though who knows?
Creativity abounds.
Indeed.
Potentially, right?
So I have two thoughts. First, kudos to the league for listening to fans who I think by and large love to see this sort of thing, and to the league for finally having a little bit of fun. And second, I just want to know which team will be the first to try to accomplish all three of these things at once. I'm thinking like a synchronized swimming style snow angel, the players tossing a football amongst themselves throughout.
That would be okay as long as they sort of remember at some point why they're there to begin with.
I've often thought that the NFL loves to have a couple of topics that people are going to just get crazy angry about. They sort of engineer some controversies, and this sort of no fun league image that they had was always good for weeks, if not years, of argumentation about whether or not the league should be cracking down this stuff. Now that they've taken away these rules and they've opened it up, and by the way, I just want to point out, Claire, these rules that you mentioned, using the football as a prop, celebrations allowed as a group, and rolling around the ground. These are all also rules of a Chuck E. Cheese that they have now integrated into professional football. The thing that I find funny about it, they find the most innocuous, charming examples of what they will allow, like the snow angels. Now, how many snow angels are you getting a season on average?
What? Dozens.
Three?
Now.
Oh. What are we going to do? Are we going to start pumping in fake snow to encourage snow angels?
Ooh, I like it.
I think it is a little discriminatory towards the Western and Southern teams, though.
Yes. Mud angels? No one wants to see that.
You know, no one is treating this topic in any way but sort of the frivolous way that it probably deserves. But I wonder if it's the NFL saying, hey, look over here, shiny things. Hey, fans, look, some great goofy celebrations. So don't worry about whether Tom Brady's had a bunch of concussions that the team doesn't know about and the league doesn't know about them.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think the NFL was very aware that they were going to get good press from this and press that would not be talking about things like Tom Brady's concussions. And Goodell himself actually poked fun at the No Fun League nickname in his announcement. But I, for one, you know, will enjoy this, even if it is mostly a distraction. And I'm curious to see what Antonio Brown is going to do. He has made a habit of dancing and twerking on the field.
But you can't do that. Twerking is absolutely not allowed under the new rules, as I understand it. It's too suggestive.
Well, we'll see. I mean, the guy has known that he's going to get fined, and I have the quote in front of me. He said that the fines were, quote-unquote, nothing to a boss.
Okay.
What's the twerking policy at Only a Game, Bill?
Happily, it has never come up.
Okay. All right.
As always, we save our most significant story for last.
Yes.
There's just no question about the most significant story this time around. Jason, you're on.
Listen, are you guys familiar with the technology of balance bikes?
Only because I familiarized myself with it for this occasion.
Okay, well, Claire, I don't know your backstory with bicycling, but like, no one rides with training wheels anymore. Training wheels have been disrupted. Everybody who wants to learn how to ride a bike now learns on a balance bike. The idea of it is that you sort of paddle along with your feet, kind of like Fred Flintstone, you know, goes to the movies. And what they do is they teach you how to ride a bike much earlier because it teaches you how to center your balance, and you just become a much more efficient rider much earlier. Now, of course, because this is America, the first thing we did as soon as we learned how to ride these things is now we race them. And Strider, which is a huge balance bike company based in South Dakota, now has a global series of toddler bike races, and they call it the world's only athletic competition for two-year-olds. How's that for a sell?
How did we get along without an athletic competition for two-year-olds? That's what I want to know.
It's amazing. You watch these kids, and these are kids, folks. These kids are still in diapers. Some of them have pacifiers as mouthpieces. They are whipping around these tracks like Olympians. In Asia, the sport is so popular. The Asian Cup recently happened. They had 800 slots. They had 3,000 people apply. They actually had to have a lottery. Mm. It's one of the weirdest things I've ever gotten the chance to see and write about. But I have to admit, I kind of liked it.
I mean, this is an incredible innovation. I will make a confession, which is that I did not learn how to ride a bike until I was 10 years old. And then I promptly forgot. I am perhaps the only person on Earth who has forgotten how to ride a bicycle.
I thought that was impossible.
Oh, it's possible. So
Claire, when someone says to you, it's just like riding a bike, you're like, no.
Oh, yeah, I get very upset. I hope it's not like that. But I'm wondering, you know, if they make adult sizes of these balance bikes, it might really change my life.
Oh, I hope not. Obviously, this is fun. And I just hope the adults will stay out of it because, Jason, I understand there is at least one professional race car driver who has been giving his toddler son tips on how to do the corners. Pretty soon he's going to be telling him how to draft behind the other kid on the little thing. I just hope the parents don't take the whole thing over. That's my worry.
Well, you know, I was a little worried about a Little Miss Sunshine vibe down there when I went to go watch one of the races. But the truth of it is, there are some parents who take it kind of seriously. They're getting in there and they're literally modifying the bikes, changing out the handlebars and the stems and stuff like that to make them more aerodynamic. All of this is true. But so far, it does not seem to be, you know, gone to that psycho hockey game, little league place that a lot of youth sports go to. And I will add that fundamentally, the utility of these bikes is to learn how to ride a bike, which I think is a very good thing because, as you know, Bill, I want the whole world on a bicycle by 2019.
Sounds very good to me. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Ringer's Claire McNear and The Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Bill.
Everybody knows that athletes who reach the highest level of competition have to devote themselves exclusively to that goal. They must be single-minded in their dedication, no time for other pursuits. Everybody knows that, except for the people who don't. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story of one such athlete, and you know the old cliche about behind every successful man? Yeah, that too.
One night in 1964, in a Pepperdine University gym, Gail Hopkins joined a pickup volleyball match. That was the first time he met a senior named Caroline.
Athletes on campus had a bad reputation, so it took a while for me to convince her I was a decent enough guy to go out with.
I turned him down the first three times he asked me out.
So she hunted around for about a week until she got a number of character references before she'd answer any of my questions.
Hopkins was a biology major and a star player on Pepperdine's baseball team.
I was very impressed by the size of his thighs. I couldn't believe anybody had thighs that big. So how's that?
That's just fine, because after allowing Caroline a little time for the necessary gauging of character beyond thigh size, Gail made an important decision.
Yeah, he proposed in 2 weeks. 2 weeks. So what can I say?
Right after Caroline graduated with a bachelor's degree in sociology, she married Gail. Thus began one of the great multitasking adventures in sports history.
She asked me what I wanted to do. So I told her I wanted to play professional baseball and be a medical missionary. And she said,
I think that's three things. Why don't you pick one?
And I just laughed and said, no, that's what I want to do. Right after we got married, we went up to Canada and I started playing baseball for $25 a week.
We played semi-pro in Canada for our honeymoon.
Sounds romantic, doesn't it? But the newlyweds were in Edmonton just for the summer, and Gail still had a degree to earn. The following two summers, he played minor league ball in Florida and California. He earned his bachelor's degree from Pepperdine in 1966. Gail says that balancing academics with baseball and marriage wasn't a problem.
Once we were married, actually, I thought it got easier. Actually, my grades went up, so.
Gail stayed on at Pepperdine in California, where he worked on a master's in religion while also playing ball in the Carolina League. Meanwhile, Caroline earned a master's in education and began work as a school teacher to augment Gail's modest minor league paycheck. Their balancing act was working. But then there was a small bump along the way.
After talking with the White Sox, I quit at the end of 1967 because Carol was pregnant and took a job at Pepperdine University teaching and working as their head baseball coach.
When the first of their two children was born, Caroline stopped teaching. But soon the major league bug bit Gale again. He returned to the White Sox farm system in 1968.
And after 6 weeks, I was sitting in a movie theater in Birmingham, Alabama, and I got tapped on my shoulder. And I thought something was wrong with my wife or kid, because the manager had to talk to me real urgent. And so I walked out into the lobby, and he told me, I got to go get dressed. I'm going to Chicago. They called me up to the big leagues.
Hopkins made his major league debut on June 29, 1968. The utility first baseman became one of the most reliable pinch hitters in the major leagues.
It was great, you know, exciting and new. And, of course, I was getting to play against Mickey Mantle, those kind of guys. It was pretty cool, actually.
But the call of academia persisted.
After the first year, I started a graduate program at the Illinois Institute of Technology. So I was playing ball in Chicago and going to graduate school, and I thought I had it made.
He did have it made. If your idea of having it made includes trying to figure out how to hit major league pitching while studying DNA mutation and fungi. But Gale Hopkins has a rare quality which made all that possible.
He can survive and did easily on like 3 hours a night of sleep. I can't do that, but he could.
I do have the ability to stay up late, work long hours, and still be rested. You know, when I went on road trips, I would take my books and my papers and I'd read them. When I went to Boston, for instance, I went to the Harvard Library.
When all the guys were going out and drinking or doing other things, he was studying, and he would study in the bullpen, and he would study all the time.
He used to play night games. Then I'd get up in the morning and I'd do my work. I did a lot of that stuff, though, in my room. Half my suitcase would be filled up with books or material that I was taking with me.
Gale played 3 seasons for the White Sox and earned his PhD in biology and biochemistry. He was traded to Kansas City and played 3 seasons with the Royals. He won a World Series ring in 1974 with Los Angeles and set sights on his next goal.
In 74, I quit at the end of the season with the Dodgers and was going to go to medical school in Mexico. But a guy came to my house, and he offered me a job to play for the Hiroshima Carp. He offered me what amounted to a $70,000 contract. Okay, the average major league salary that year was $36,000. The most I'd ever made was $31,000. This was an opportunity to go play baseball in Japan for 1 year, and that would help really pay for our medical school.
The Hopkins moved to Japan, where the new challenge was to raise their children in a foreign country and to help revive a terrible team.
The joke was, where are the Carp? They're at the bottom, like they always are. All they'd ever done was lose. Well, I had a great season. I broke the club's home run record, and then I hit a home run at the next to last game of the regular season to win the championship.
Gale began his medical studies remotely while playing pro ball in Japan for 3 seasons. He retired from baseball in 1977. After more than 30 moves in 13 years, during which time they had never been together once on their wedding anniversary, Caroline and Gale returned to the U.S. Gale finished his medical degree at Rush Medical College, and Caroline had ambitions of her own.
Well, when he was in medical school, I decided that if we were going to do medical missionary work, I would rather have my own credentials and not just be the wife that was helping. So I went to nursing school and got my RN degree.
That was the last, or perhaps just the latest, of Caroline's 5 degrees. She worked as a nurse, but the Hopkins never did medical missionary work. Gale's specialty is orthopedic surgery, and he says getting the proper equipment to remote locations is just about impossible. Gale also earned 5 degrees, adding a master's in divinity for good measure. He's now 74 years old. He's thankful for his 28-year medical career and proud of what he accomplished on the diamond, but
all that stuff's really only possible because of the kinds of contributions that Carol made in the whole process.
That is true, and I'm glad he recognizes it.
For Only a Game, I'm Gary Wallach.
We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. C.H. Pirates Nut left us the following review on iTunes. Consistently thoughtful, funny, and engaging. I love the give and take with Charlie Pierce. Looking at the OAG website, I see Pierce has the perfect face for radio. I wonder what Charlie would think of that.
I don't deny a word of that, especially the good stuff.
Consider visiting iTunes and leaving a review of your own. It's the best way to help other listeners find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the shifting fortunes of the Golden State Warriors, from the Sprewell Carlissimo incident to their present glory. But now it's time for my discussion of the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The NBA Finals will begin on Thursday, and we have a matchup, and it's the same matchup we've really gotten used to, right? Vegas likes the Warriors. What about you?
I still like the Cavaliers. It's hard to tell anything about either team based on the playoffs.
Boy, I'll say.
Because it was such a romp. But I still think the Cavaliers have a little bit of a toughness edge on the Warriors.
Is it a good thing or a bad thing that there are two teams so far ahead of their respective conferences?
Well, the last time this happened in the NBA, it had the greatest decade of its existence in the 1980s with the Celtics and the Lakers. So I think precedent is on the side of it being good for the game.
In helping the Cavs defeat the Celtics on Thursday night, LeBron James became the NBA's all-time leading scorer in the postseason, surpassing some guy named Jordan. Are we witnessing the best playoff performance ever?
Well, certainly the best scorer in the playoffs. I mean, that's undeniable. But until he has as much jewelry as Michael has, you got to say no.
We also have a pairing in the Stanley Cup Finals. Beginning on Monday, Pittsburgh will face Nashville. Who do you like there?
I like the very fact of Pittsburgh and Nashville. But, you know, I've been on the Preds bandwagon ever since the playoffs started, so I have no reason to jump off now.
All right. If the Predators win, does Nashville stop being Music City and become Hockey Town USA?
I think at least for a couple of weeks, the parade itself would be great.
We have talked about the alleged felonious behavior of former Baylor football players, Charlie, and the culture in which that behavior thrived and was ignored or condoned. Are you surprised that so many men who were assistant coaches in that program have found coaching jobs elsewhere?
Quite frankly, yeah. It's almost as if the entire industry of college sports is trying to bury this thing. But, you know, it apparently is not a black mark in any way on your resume.
Team England captain Wayne Rooney has been left off the team's roster. He had announced his plan to retire from international soccer after the 2018 World Cup. So much for that plan, I guess. They beat him to it.
Yeah, it's really remarkable since Wayne Rooney is one of the three international soccer players whose names I know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it grieves me because I may never again hear a crowd of English fans sing the Wayne Rooney song. Would you like to hear it?
I'd love to hear the Wayne Rooney song.
Wayne Rooney, Wayne Rooney. Wayne Rooney, Wayne Rooney, put one in for England, Wayne Rooney.
There's something very circular about the lyrics. I can't quite put my finger on it.
Yeah, you probably recognize the tune as well.
No, I didn't. Frankly, Bill, I didn't recognize the tune.
It was supposed to be Let It Be. Was I that far off key?
Okay. I've just never heard it sung in the key of Asia Minor before.
At the recent Boston University commencement exercises, David Ortiz was awarded an honorary degree. Good choice by the Honorary Degree Committee?
I think it's terrific. I really do. I don't know what he'll do with it, but, you know, it's good to know that he's a doctor of humane home runs.
Leland's is auctioning some Babe Ruth items. I don't usually talk about this sort of thing, but they've got the original contract that sent Ruth from Boston to New York. How much do you think the contract will bring at auction?
Well, now that the Red Sox have actually won a World Series, I'm assuming the price has gone down a little bit. So I'll say around $5 million.
I don't have any idea. I don't want it.
My understanding is there's a couple of them, though. He had to get one and the Yankees had to get one, right? The one they're auctioning off now, was it written on hammered gold?
All right, here's a story for you, Charlie. Indy 500 pole sitter Scott Dixon and former IndyCar Series driver Dario Franchitti were robbed at a Taco Bell drive-thru last Sunday. Tell me it was because they weren't driving through fast enough.
I don't know. It's definitely one of the odder sports crimes we've ever had.
See, I think they broke the first rule of racing, which is don't stop.
That's right.
Cubs manager Joe Maddon has done it again, Charlie. He has decreed that next week's West Coast road trip will pay homage to Ron Burgundy and the rest of the cast of the movie Anchorman. Classy move, huh?
Well, I need to know if Champ Kind is going to be doing the play-by-play. Whammy!
Yeah, and they are going to San Diego, so it works.
That's right, San Diego.
Finally, Charlie, a baseball great will be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame this weekend. How do you feel about the enshrinement of Homer Simpson?
I have no idea what's going on here. But I don't know exactly what Homer's credentials are.
There was a Hall of Fame episode which included several baseball greats, including Wade Boggs, as a matter of fact.
Okay. So now what? Homer's going to get his own plaque?
I guess.
So Homer Simpson gets into the Hall of Fame before Roger Clemens.
And before Pete Rose.
That'll work.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
This is Rand Paul.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Wait, hold on. Don't turn this off, please. I promise we're not going to talk about the news from Washington. This is a story about a baseball game, the congressional baseball game. Still with us? I hope so. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Senator Rand Paul wants you to know something about the Republican baseball team.
We really try to win. There's no messing around. This isn't kind of like the Washington Generals versus the Harlem Globetrotters. We are trying. It may not look like we're trying.
Each summer, Republican and Democratic lawmakers meet in the congressional baseball game. Since before Paul took office in 2011, the Republicans have been in a bit of a slump. And there's a simple reason for that. The Democrats have a ringer. Cedric Richmond, a rep from Louisiana, pitched in college. Word on the Hill is he can still sling it in the 80s.
And they're not ashamed of keeping him in hell or high water. If they're ahead 27-0, they're pitching him in the last inning.
Now, just to be fair, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but not much of one. In 2013, the Democrats did win 22-0, and Richmond did pitch the whole game. In 2014, the Democrats won 15-6. In 2015, it was 5-2. That marked the seventh straight GOP loss. But Rand Paul and his Republican teammates still showed up to Nationals Park again last June for the annual game. Going into that game, what was sort of the talk in the Republican locker room?
Well, you know, for years the talk had been that those damn Democrats, you know, they believe in so many regulations that we should propose a new regulation, and the regulation should be that their best pitcher should only be allowed to pitch for two innings. But we found it quite ironic that as much as they love regulating the economy, not one of them was for this new baseball regulation to limit their best players' pitching time.
So the pesky Democrats once again gave the ball to Richmond. But this time, the Republicans caught up to him. And in the final inning, with the score tied at 7, Republican Tom Rooney stepped to the plate with a runner on third. Rooney singled, and the Republicans won.
We were quite excited and were anxious to defend our title this year.
This year's game will be played on June 15th, as specified by our founding fathers in the Constitution. Nah, just kidding. But where does this silly tradition come from? Turns out, the idea behind it wasn't so silly. Let's go back to an era not unlike our own.
It was pretty tense in both the House and the Senate. People just kind of stopped talking to each other.
That's Mary Craig. She's a PhD student in political science at Baylor University, and she's been researching the first decade of the 20th century.
There were a lot of companies, particularly in Europe, who wanted to get into and create an American market for their products.
The big issue was tariffs. Democrats wanted them higher to protect U.S. industry. New Republican President William Howard Taft wanted to lower them to boost consumerism. When Taft took office in 1909, he immediately tried to push through his agenda.
So he created a special congressional session just to try and pass a tariff bill. It did not go smoothly at all. The Senate and the House Republicans had vastly different ideas of what they wanted the bill to look like.
Sound familiar? Anyways, on one side there were the House Republicans, who mostly backed the president's plan. And on the other were wealthy Republican senators, who Craig says wanted to raise certain tariffs to protect their own companies from foreign competition.
People just could not come to an agreement even within their own party.
One of the Republicans in the House who supported Taft's effort to lower tariffs was a fellow from Pennsylvania named John Tenner. Tenner was a newcomer to Congress, and he had taken an unusual path to office. After losing both his parents at a young age, Tenner became the first in his family to graduate from high school. He was a good athlete, and in 1888, he joined the Chicago White Stockings as a pitcher.
His very first start in the major leagues, he lost 14-0. So, I mean, at that point, it's like, could it possibly get worse?
In Tenner's case, the answer was sort of yes. After two decent years in Chicago, he joined his hometown Pittsburgh Burghers. He posted a 3-11 record with an ERA over 7. It was his last season in Major League Baseball. Tenner transitioned to finance and worked his way up from teller to bank president. He was known in town for personally greeting customers. With a rags-to-riches story plus a dash of sports celebrity, Tenner was a blue-chip political prospect. And in 1908, he ran for the House and won. Tenner favored lowering tariffs, but perhaps his bigger concern was the growing strife within the Republican Party.
He thought that all this infighting would damage their control over Congress as well as any sort of momentum they had gained. And so he was very concerned that this would kind of be the end of the Republican Party and therefore, you know, be the end of his political career. So he wanted to try and reconcile the party.
His big plan was a charity baseball game. It would pit the Republicans against the Democrats, and his logic was pretty straightforward.
Who among the Republicans could fight with one another when they had to do battle with the Democrats?
So the Republicans were in. Then Tenner went to the Democrats.
So at first, the Democrats were really into the game, and then they realized that, oh no, there was this major league pitcher who was, you know, going to be the captain of the Republican team. You know, as poor as he had been in the majors, he was still, you know, a lot better than anybody they had to offer. So they went to the Republicans and they essentially said, okay, we'll do this little charity game, but he cannot pitch against us because we don't want to look like fools.
The Republicans agreed and the game was on. Leading up to game day, Tenner's plan seemed to be working. In their free time, the Republicans gathered for rounds of catch. And on July 16th, 1909, 1,000 people ponied up a couple quarters each for a ticket to D.C.'s American League Park to watch the congressman take the field. It was an odd-looking bunch. Some wore straw hats, others preferred bowlers. Those who could fit into baseball pants wore them. The game started respectably. It was tied at 2 after one inning. And then things started to fall apart. General fitness was a key problem.
More than one player collapsed rounding second base and had to be subsequently kind of removed from the game or offered refreshments to try and revitalize them.
Even those who remained upright on the base path sometimes struggled to remember which way to run. And defense wasn't much better.
None of the outfielders caught any fly balls. They just kind of, like, let them drop.
A bold strategy.
There were a lot of errors, and then at a certain point, they just kind of stopped counting errors because they had trouble figuring out who to specifically assign them to.
So neither team had much talent, but the Democrats did have a plan, or at least a willingness to bend the rules. Going into the contest, the two sides had agreed to stick with 9 players for the entire game. But early on, the Democrats started subbing in fresh players. In a game in which some participants couldn't run 180 feet, that was a tremendous advantage. So this is where the partisanship really started, probably, was the Democrats cheating in this baseball game.
That's what I assume, yeah. Because, you know, once a cheater, always a cheater. So.
Right. There's some debate over the final score. Maybe it was 26-16. But everyone agrees the Democrats won. Minority congressmen wallop Republican colleagues, read one newspaper headline. But how about John Tenner's brilliant plan to unite the Republican Party?
Okay, so after this game, it did nothing to solve the issues of the Republican Party because, like, of course it didn't. So
I can't
they
believe
went,
it.
I know. So then they went back to Congress and, you know, eventually after a lot of fighting, they compromised a lot on the bill.
And by compromise, Craig means the wealthy senators mostly got their way. The Payne-Aldrich Tariff Act was signed into law on August 5th, 1909. What's been the legacy of the bill that did eventually get passed?
It was completely torn apart by basically everybody in the country. People point to this as the destruction of the Republican Party at this point in time. So it's not a really, really great legacy for the bill.
No, you wouldn't think. In the 1910 congressional elections, the Democrats took control of the House, and the Republican Party split in two, the progressives and the old guard. So John Tenner wasn't able to unite the Republican Party, but he did leave an unexpected legacy.
People just kind of loved seeing these old portly fellows, you know, give baseball a go. Everybody absolutely loved the game. They thought it was just like the funniest thing that they had ever seen.
Funny would be good in Washington these days, right?
Absolutely. Play ball.
For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
To learn more about the first congressional baseball game, check out Mary Craig's article for the Hardball Times titled A Comedy of Errors. You can find a link at onlyagame.org. Of Southern hospitality, I often have heard tell, and I've no doubt that lots of people practice it as well, but at a ball game in Atlanta, maybe not so much. On Wednesday night at SunTrust Park, a fan leaned out to touch a batted ball. It was in play, the fan was doubtless wrong, and he earned boos aplenty from the portion of the throng that saw him. Then he gave that baseball to a little boy, whose smile was large and grateful, and it radiated joy. But then a guard appeared, restoring order on his mind. Though chaos wasn't evident, the fellow wasn't blind. The rules said he should heave the man who'd interfered with play. He saw the boy who had the ball and grabbed the ball away. Now, this was not a riot. It was nothing all that bad. But what the guard brought to his duty made the whole thing sad. It shouldn't be that way in baseball, should it? As in life, a measured sort of first response can sometimes limit strife. This story has a happy ending. See, what the Braves did, they got another baseball, and they gave it to the kid. And I, for one, am hoping that the guard I cannot name got pulled aside and told, "Hey, fella, it's only a game." Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Gibbon. Our final word comes from Gail Hopkins' wife, Caroline. Or is it Carol?
Carol is fine. Lots of people call me Gail.
Really?
Yes, and my really good friends call him Carol.
Ah, yes. And are either of you ever called late for dinner? Sometimes it's just hanging up there for you. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.